You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa ko Kaden Tokawingawa. Nō mai, haere mai, ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rā Pārē Thursday. My name is Kaden, I'm your host for today and I'll be with you for the next hour. E wha Akene coming up on the show for politics with Marnie Dunlop from Te Ao Māori News. I'll be asking about a new investment from the government in Māori businesses and funding for Māori organisations in Budget 2026. And I spoke to Professor Jehan Gunasekera, a privacy law expert at the University of Auckland Business School, about a new Green Party policy that would fine individuals and businesses for privacy breaches. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, News Director Castor spoke with Shannon Halbert about the party's newly announced $20 fare cap and their broader policy plan for this year's election. And Castor spoke to Professor Michael Baker from the University of Otago about influenza management and improving New Zealand's public health response. He aha o whakaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395, or wire mai rāne, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Ka aue wari wari iaki ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ene kōrero anō. He pakahere rukiruki mārunga i te pai, tukutuku o Irirangi Poho, mi haere ki 95BFM, irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Text in your thoughts, 5395, or give us a call in studio on toru kore iwa toru waru fitu iwa, 309-3879. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with Labour MP Shannon Halbert.
Labour has announced its first major policy in over 6 months, a proposal to cap public transport costs at $20 per week in major centres and $10 a week elsewhere. The party says the policy would help with the cost of living and make public transport more accessible. The announcement comes after the coalition government removed several public transport subsidies introduced under Labour, including half-priced fares for young people and free fares for children. Alongside the fare cap, Labour has already announced a targeted capital gains tax to fund 3 free GP visits a year and a proposed future fund aimed at investing in infrastructure and innovative Kiwi businesses. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, News Director Castor spoke with Shannon Halbert about these policies.
So Labour has announced this policy to cap public transport costs at $20 a week in major centres and $10 elsewhere. For listeners who maybe haven't followed the announcement or haven't heard about it yet, what exactly would this policy do and what's the Labour Party's goal in introducing it?
Yeah, with Labour's policy, people will be able to get where they're going for less. We're focused on a cost of living response for this particular policy and we'll continue to roll those out. For public transport users here in Tāmaki Makaurau, Auckland and Wellington and Christchurch, they will receive a fare cap of no more than $20 per week to use public transport, and that includes trains, it includes buses, and for those in my electorate in Northcote, it also includes the Northcote Ferry and Birkenhead Ferry. So it's a real win-win for our city. It enables people to use public transport for less, but also enables people to use public transport overall, reduce congestion, and get to where they're going to faster and easier.
Some of our public transport services, particularly in Auckland, have struggled with higher numbers, particularly at the start of the fuel crisis. Is there a worry that decreasing the cost could increase demand and maybe necessitate upgrades to some of our public transport services?
Auckland Transport's done a good job of getting transport patronage up to close to where it was pre-COVID, over on the North Shore and Northcote. We're the second highest user of public transport across Auckland, and we have a very reliable service going into the city and beyond. So ACs are able to respond to that demand, but most of all at the moment it's about enabling cost of living relief for everyday users, whether you're a student going to university, whether you're a working person that goes to the city, that the most they'll pay every single week is $20 to use public transport here in Auckland.
And how is Labor paying for this policy?
Well, that will come out of the existing National Land Transport Fund. It's less than 1% of the overall fund. We know that there was cuts under this government to that fund under the national government. But it's important that over time we are increasing our investment in public transport. But as I said, less than 1% of the overall National Land Transport Fund will go to funding this particular policy. It's a good use of taxpayer money. It's making things cheaper for people and it's enabling our transport system overall.
And this is Labor's first new policy announcement in over 6 months. Looking across the policies that we've seen announced thus far, and obviously you can't tell us what the upcoming policy announcements might be, but thinking about that general vision behind them, what's Labor's broader approach to this year's election? What are the messages that they're trying to get across?
Labor's focused on a more affordable New Zealand. That means that our vision and focus will be on jobs, health, homes, and real action on the cost of living. We have previously announced the 3 free GP visits for every single person in our country. That will make it cheaper to go to the doctors. Some people have been facing up to $100 in order to see their local GP. So there'll be some savings there for them. But it'll also take the pressure off our emergency departments. We know that if people go to the doctor in advance, that they're less likely to end up in ED. That's important. Primary health care is an important part of our health system and we want to enable people to access that.
These policies have seen some criticism from opposition parties for increasing demand for these services by reducing cost without also announcing policies to improve or make more resilient the supply. Is that something that Labor's also looking into, more investments in our public transport services, more investments in our health sector to ensure that the sector can respond to this increase in demand?
The Labor Party is focused on real action on the cost of living, and we will see attacks from the National Party because they promise 2 things. They promise to fix the economy and they promise to provide cost of living relief to all New Zealanders. They've failed on both accounts, and so it's our job to come up as an effective opposition and a future government to make sure that we are able to inform New Zealanders that cost of living relief is available and it's political choices that enable such relief.
And the government has also criticised this policy for just simply being a new tax, right? These GP visits are going to be funded through a capital gains tax. What does Labor have to say about that? You know, the introduction of a new tax, is this something that the public should see as bad, or what should the reaction be, in your view?
Well, the capital gains tax introduced by Labor will only affect 1 in 10 New Zealanders. It's a targeted capital gains tax. It doesn't affect your family home. And so it's unlikely that most New Zealanders will even interact with the capital gains tax. What's important here is that every dollar that was raised by capital gains tax will be invested back into our health system. That's how we're paying for the 3 free GP visits. That's how we enable New Zealanders to go to the doctor when they need to. And that's how we take pressure off our health system overall.
And critics on the other side have pointed out that Labor ruled out a capital gains tax last election, and even this capital gains tax seems a lot more restrained when you compare it to some of the taxes we've seen overseas. What's changed between then and now, and could we see a capital gains tax developed further to mirror some of those models that we see in other countries?
Well, I think a lot's changed in the last 3 years. As we have come out of COVID and the economy, in fact, under Christopher Luxon and the National Party, has got worse. People had hoped for a better outcome. They haven't received that. And so it's our job to put up new policies, new opportunities, different ways of doing things so that people can see an alternative pathway forward from the reality of the National-led government at the moment. People want a bit of hope. They desperately want relief from cost of living. They're challenged by that. And so that's what we're focused on this election: jobs, health, homes, and real action on the cost of living.
Labor's also proposed a future fund, which it says would invest in infrastructure and innovate New Zealand businesses. What and innovative New Zealand businesses, what is the problem that the fund is designed to solve right now?
Well, we want to make sure that the funds that we do have is used to build productivity and innovation in New Zealand. As I said, that we're focused on enabling our economy for it to be more productive, to grow the number of jobs that are available to New Zealanders. We've seen some of the worst unemployment that we've seen in over a decade in this country, particularly impacting young people. So the investment fund is really about enabling growth, enabling productivity, supporting businesses, and doing better with the money that we have available, investing it properly and growing that fund.
And you mentioned unemployment there. A lot of the jobs that are opening up right now, even if they are jobs that would typically be made available for young people, have got very high requirements for qualifications, and employers are often looking for skilled workers because there's such a high unemployed population that there are these opportunities for employers. How can we be confident that these jobs that would be created through the Future Fund would be able to go to young people in Aotearoa?
Well, Labor's track record says that we had the lowest unemployment that we had in a very long time during the COVID response. We chose to invest in livelihoods and in jobs, and we saw that the unemployment number drop as a result. That's not what this government has done. They've pulled the rug out from under New Zealanders. They've cancelled jobs. That includes in the public service. And so we want to get that going again, and that's our focus: jobs, health, homes and real action on the cost of living.
That was Labor's Shannon Halbert speaking to News Director Castor about the party's new $20 fare cap policy and how it fits into their broader election plan.
That was our weekly chat with Labor MP Shannon Halbert.
Well, if you want to save money in health, it's very simple, you know. It's like shoot all the patients and shut all the hospitals.
The Wire.
The Green Party has announced a new policy to fine individuals and companies for privacy breaches. This includes fines of up to $500,000 for breaches by individuals and $10 million for corporations. Similar to the Australian model, the penalty would be decided by the courts and paid to the government. I spoke to Professor Jihan Gunasekara, a privacy law expert at the University of Auckland Business School, about this proposal. I started by asking if he could explain the current laws for individuals and businesses who breach privacy.
Your listeners need to understand that there are New Zealand has a two-track enforcement system in New Zealand, where people can complain to the Privacy Commissioner, but the Privacy Commissioner independently has the power to see if organisations are committing serious interferences with privacy, and then on his own account he can make compliance orders against organisations. And at the moment, if they then don't comply, his power is to impose a fine, which is relatively low by world standards. It's only $10,000. But if individuals sue and they bring a complaint and then they're not happy with the outcome of the complaint, they can then sue in the Human Rights Review Tribunal. They can get substantial damages against an agency that has caused them privacy harm, and that can be up to $350,000. So we have a two-track system. What's been missing in action, I think, is that the people have had to advocate for themselves, go to the tribunal, bring claims against organisations, but the commissioner has only brought a handful of compliance notices against agencies, and that, I think, is very disappointing.
And how would the Green Party's proposal on fining privacy breaches work in practice with this existing system?
Well, it's well-intentioned, but I think it's a bit crude, and I don't think fining people for a privacy breach is necessarily the way to go about it. I think you need to fine people for unsafe privacy practices that led to or contributed to a privacy breach. I think that is the better approach, and I think perhaps that is what it's meant. But reading their policy, it's a bit unclear as to how it would, how it would operate. But I think you can't sort of simply fine people because there's a privacy breach, because the privacy breach may have happened despite the most robust security in the world. As we know, a determined hacker can still penetrate organizations. So, but what you want to do though is to give the power to the commissioner to investigate and then see if the agency had not had up to speed, up to scratch privacy practices, as was found recently with the Manage My Health breach. Then the commissioner should be able to impose a fine. And so I would support that if that is what is intended, because currently, if you look at what happened with the Manage My Health breach, that commissioner has found inadequate, lax privacy practices, but all he can now do is to serve a compliance notice on Manage My Health. And then only if they then fail to comply with that does he have the power to fine. Now, I think he should have had the power to impose a fine immediately if he finds that those practices weren't up to scratch. So the Australian, if I can contrast that with Australia, they have, for lower level infringements, a civil penalty regime. So the commissioner there can almost, it's like an on-the-spot fine. You have been failing to have adequate protection and we're going to impose a fine. For the more serious interferences, that in Australia would still require people to be taken through to the courts and so on.
My understanding is the UK has some kind of monetary reparation scheme for privacy breaches. How does the Green Party's proposal compare to what the UK has enacted?
Yeah, that's a great question. The UK has had this for a very long time, even before it had it now is aligned with the European GDPR, even though the UK is not part of the European Union, but it's still very much a GDPR-oriented regime that they have there, which is the European Privacy Regulation. But what they can do there is they can impose monetary penalties on agencies for privacy failures. But once again, it's not necessarily for a privacy breach. The monetary penalty is usually for practices that contributed to or led to the privacy breach. So the analogy that I draw here, and this is one hopefully people will be able to follow, the analogy is with a car accident. So let's say somebody causes an accident, they crash their car. Now, of course, you know, that could result in a traffic infringement and a conviction for unsafe driving or whatever. But it's not the accident that you are being punished for. You know, obviously the accident was the outcome of your unsafe driving, but the conviction of the driver in that case is for the driving that led to the accident. It's not for having the accident itself, if you follow my logic. So it's a similar kind of thing for privacy breaches.
And in places that do have stronger penalty measures, is there any evidence that it has prevented potential privacy breaches?
Oh, that's a $64 million question. I wish I had the answer to that. And I think it would need research over a very long period of time to see whether there was a decrease, but I'd be surprised if, you know, having more robust consequences for failure to protect people's privacy doesn't lead to an increase in measures to protect security, privacy, or the security of personal information. Of course, there will still be attacks, there will be ransomware, there will still be hacks. There'll be accidental or inadvertent mistake. People make mistakes, and even if you have the best privacy training in your organization and you have all the measures in place, people can still make mistakes. And that's why we have a regime now in New Zealand where notification is required. So, in answer to your first or your original question, the law in New Zealand since 2020 is that if an agency suffers a privacy breach, then it has to, within a reasonable time, notify the individuals concerned if there are serious potential consequences for them. And at the same time, it's got to notify the Office of the Privacy Commissioner. Now, there are various exceptions for notification, but those exceptions don't apply to the commissioner. So agencies need to, as soon as possible, notify the commissioner. And it's only if it's found that they failed to make that notification, then again, that could attract a fine. But, you know, all of this is a very convoluted, long-winded kind of way of enforcing. And I think what the Greens are suggesting would be helpful if we were to give the Commissioner a power, as in Australia, to impose on-the-spot fines where it's found that the practices leading up to the breach were the ones that contributed to the breach. Well, then, you know, there should be a consequence for that. I think I'd be supportive of that, but I wouldn't be supporting fines just for an agency just because it suffered a privacy breach, because you need to look at why the breach happened, who is at fault, I think it would be unfair on agencies if they were to be just fined every time they suffered a privacy breach.
And I want to finish by asking, this discussion has been in the context of Green Party policy, but given the recent high-profile privacy breaches, most notably Manage My Health, have you noticed any other political parties talking about privacy in New Zealand?
No, but I believe the Privacy Foundation it normally releases the policies of the of the various parties, and I can't speak for the foundation, but I believe that they have done this in the past, and then they publish on their website what the different political parties' positions are in terms of reforming or improving privacy law. And I think it's a good time, given that it's an election issue. What I would ask people to lobby their representatives is not only in terms of policies, but also funding. The Privacy Commissioner has suffered cuts, just like all public sector agencies recently that have been, you know, cash strapped, and there's a limit to what you can do if you don't have the money to do it. And so really people need to pressure their politicians to say we value privacy as much as we value you know, the police or any other agency, because ultimately personal information is really valuable, and if your identity is stolen, that could be a life-changing event. So I think people should put real pressure on politicians to put their money where their mouth is and say, not only will we toughen up the laws, there's no point toughening the laws if you don't have an office that can then follow through and enforce it. And I think the Commissioner currently does have significant powers, but to some extent they're being constrained because, you know, there's only so much money to go around.
That was Professor Jihan Gunasekera, a privacy law expert at the University of Auckland Business School, on a new Green Party policy that would fine individuals and businesses for privacy breaches.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the beat. Text in your thoughts 5395. This is Katie Manama from Marlon Williams.
why do you think less students are choosing to study at university?
Well, because being a student isn't sexy anymore.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. The government has announced it is investing $5 million into Māori-owned businesses as part of initiatives to support economic growth and create jobs. It follows a mixed bag of funding and cuts to Māori organisations in Budget 2026. For Politics with Marnie Dunlop from Te Ao Māori News, I have Marnie on the line to discuss these recent announcements. Marnie, could you start by outlining the government's new $5 million investment into Māori-owned businesses?
Kia ora, So you say at Field Days, Tama Potaka announced the $5.3 million into the Māori Development Fund. And so the aim of that is to invest into helping grow Māori-owned business, and create jobs and strengthen regional economies. And obviously been at Field Days supporting horticulture and agriculture developments. And a lot of that, actually part of that announcement is around renewable energy as well, and into a lot of the solar power kind of investments that we are seeing up and down the country. But I mean, like, if you look at the $5.3 million, it does seem like a bit of a drop in the bucket in the scheme of things, which is similar to the budget and Māori focus funding as well.
And I'm curious, what has been the reaction of Māori business leaders to this announcement?
Yeah, I mean, Māori businesses are going to welcome any help or any investment into the mahi that they're doing. But also remember the Māori economy and the Māori dollar, essentially, especially globally, has been doing really well and feeds millions, if not billions, into the wider economy and into the GDP. So, I mean, this will be a good top-up for a lot of the businesses in terms of just kind of getting the reach out there a bit more and also adding to what Tama Potaka, Minister of Māori Development, is having to kind of fight for and scrap for in terms of any Māori targeted funding under this coalition government.
And I do want to ask about Budget 2026 as well, because there were a few funding announcements for Māori organisations. Can you go through what was in the budget for Māori?
Yeah, for sure. So obviously a little bit biased. there was a big drop for Māori media funding. So that was a $48 million funding increase over 4 years for Māori broadcasting. So that's focusing on te reo Māori content and digital transformation. And so obviously that move away from linear. Te Ao Māori News is similar. We don't have linear news on. We're all digital, because that's, as you know, and a lot of us know, especially for Māori, that's where our audience is. So this was the kind of the big announcement and the largest new Māori-specific initiative in the budget. But then if you look at it in context, Te Māngai Pāho will retain its baseline funding. So that funding comes from Tony Corkery, and then a lot of what they had topped up will be going into that fund. So it's kind of really a reallocation of that money. The other kind of funding drop in the budget for Māori-specific funding was $10 million over 5 years for Te Māori 2, which is the new national strategy to support the international profile and return of Tonga Māori. So a cool little kaupapa there. And there's some funding for kaupapa Māori school property growth. But again, in amongst the, over $2 billion budget funding into education, I think it was $21 million for Kura Kaupapa. So again, I think almost 1% of that wider funding. Another kind of little takeaway is capital funding toward a new court complex in Rotorua, which is a Māori land court. But you would have also seen, and I know BFM has been covering it quite closely, the climate policy funding. And so as part of the budget, it ended the wider almost $30 million Māori climate platform, which has been whittling down, and which is whittled down even more so now. But it was kind of interesting. They made the announcement, well, it wasn't in the budget, but then a couple of days later, Simon Watts made the announcement saying that they'd fund like two Māori climate policies that were kind of smaller projects. So overall, I mean, last year there wasn't much more to cut in this year's budget, because Māori housing was, and Māori health especially, there was nothing really targeted, and it's going back to the government's approach into kind of that universal approach of putting funding into the, so that it's not race targeted or Māori or Pacific targeted, which obviously a lot of Māori leaders, iwi leaders are criticising heavily, and When I think I spoke to you before the budget, I was saying that a lot of our leaders were saying that we should be prepared to be disappointed. And despite those little kind of drops, or what they call lolly scrambles, there wasn't much else significant for Māori within this budget.
You've touched on this a bit already, but a lot of the headlines coming out about the budget have been on where the cuts and savings are. How will these impact Māori and Māori organisations?
Yeah, so obviously in terms of public sector, we saw pre-budget that Nicola Willis was planning on getting rid of almost 9,000 public sector jobs. And so what we've seen since then, and what we've seen kind of over the broader public sector cuts, that the first on the chopping block have been Māori teams, treaty-focused teams as well. And I remember asking, when that announcement was made, I asked the minister around, should Māori be worried? And they didn't really push back on that, to be honest, and they were very clear that it's just part of, they have to cut all of these jobs in order to kind of make room and to make money for things that they can spend the budget on. But I mean, also, I guess in light and in more context around the treaty review clause, we saw that at the Waitangi Tribunal last week. And so rather in terms of taking it away from budget or kind of focus into Māori targeted initiatives, what we're also seeing is this kind of the broader agenda around of the erosion of treaty obligations within our legislation and the government. And what the tribunal showed us was that the government had completely ignored advice from their officials and from the ministry, and telling them that no one knew what the impact of this was going to be, and it's likely going to have a very big negative impact on treaty rights and Māori rights within Aotearoa if this clause review does go through.
Now that we're a few weeks out from the budget announcement, what has the response and reactions from the community been? And also within Parliament, what have opposition MPs been saying about the budget?
Yeah, I mean, opposition, especially Greens and Te Pāti Māori, were really clear that the lolly scrambles, as I've mentioned, is the term that gets bandied around quite often, that this is just, again, another example of this government not wanting to focus on Māori-specific targeted initiatives and things that really go to the core of the inequities and the disproportionality that Māori do face in terms of a lot of our social outcomes. And so I think one of the headlines for the Greens was that this budget completely fails Māori, and that was the trend. But then, you know, the question obviously is what would you do? What would the other parties do as an alternative around how could they serve Māori if they were in power, if they were to be voted in at the next election? And I guess more broadly, because a lot of them will be putting together a lot of their policies based on now knowing what the budget looks like and going into an election year, that they'll be bringing back a lot of what Labor had done, you know, in terms of the Māori Health Authority and a lot of the other Māori-focused funding around education especially, and within other and jobs, training schemes and those sorts of things. So, yeah, I mean, still in terms of what those policies look like from the opposition, of what they could counter it with, we're yet to be seen, which I hate using that term in news or on radio. But, yeah, we'll see it in the coming weeks. And obviously this week with Labor's announcement of $20 of free public transport and $10 outside of those centres, are just some of the things that we'll start to see.
And I just want to finish by asking, for our younger listeners, what does the budget mean for rangatahi Māori in particular?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And I mean, you know, we saw that we've obviously fifth fees free, that's been scrapped, but one of the announcements within the budget was that they were going to start funding trades training scheme, which was going to cater to a lot of regional and rural communities, which in turn would serve a lot of our rangatahi Māori as well. So that's kind of the, and of Kura Kaupapa as well, like a bit funny I just mentioned about education. But in terms of wider, there was nothing really hugely focused. And the last budget was also, there wasn't anything majorly targeting our rangatahi, especially in the face of, at the moment, especially in the face of massive youth unemployment and what we're seeing, some of your record highs of youth unemployment, especially among rangatahi Māori. So I guess on that note, just making sure everyone's getting enrolled to vote and knowing and understanding the policies in which would serve them and serve their communities and serve their whānau.
Kia ora, thank you so much for your time today, Māni. I really appreciate it.
Kia ora.
That was Marnie Dunlop from Tau Māori News on a new investment from the government in Māori businesses and funding for Māori organisations in Budget 2026.
I'm not sure of our position on that particular bill, so I can't comment on that right now.
It's a kind of bird. This is the bird they're endorsing for Bird of the Year.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the beat and text in your thoughts on any of these pieces. 5395, this is some LCD sound system.
is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
The Wire.
Influenza poses significant health risks in Aotearoa, which are exacerbated by low awareness and a tendency to dismiss its impacts. Recently, Pharmac announced that the government will fund influenza vaccines for those aged 6 months and 6 years old. While the decision should increase New Zealand's resilience to the illness, more can still be done to ensure the country is safe from both influenza and other diseases. To discuss the impacts of influenza, the new policy announcement, and what more can be done to reduce the impacts of disease on society, News Director Kester spoke to Professor Michael Baker from the University of Otago.
Yeah, so to set us off on influenza, it's a disease that a lot of people will dismiss because it comes around every year and because it's quite common for people to get. What are the consequences of influenza on the individual and also on, you know, communities and society more broadly?
Well, influenza is still in many ways the most impactful single infectious disease in New Zealand. Our modelling work has shown that it results in 500 or more deaths every winter. So there's no other infectious disease apart from COVID-19 that comes close to having that impact on mortality. So we need to take influenza very seriously. It also puts thousands of people in hospital every year. And the other thing to remember is that after you have a bout of influenza, and people who've had it will say that it is one of the most extreme experiences they've had in terms of their health, it does often leave quite lasting effects, as most severe infectious diseases do. And one of the problems with influenza is that people say, oh, it's just the flu. And they're often mixing it up with all the other respiratory infections you get over winter. You know, the common cold, maybe other, there's over 100 respiratory viruses that come around and can make you sick. But influenza is really in a class of its own in terms of its severity.
And what kind of demographics does influenza primarily affect?
In terms of risk of infection, it's right across the whole age range, but the highest rates are seen in young children under 5 because they don't have highly developed immunity at that stage. And the most severe illness is seen in older people, often in their 70s or 80s or even older, where their immune system is not working as well. That's called immune senescence. And they tend to get much sicker, go to hospital, and unfortunately every year quite a few die from this infection.
And we've recently seen, to kind of combat this, as you mentioned, a new announcement that Pharmac will supply the vaccine for free for everyone from 6 months to 6 years of age. How important is a change like this? What are the kind of consequences we could be seeing across society?
Well, there's multiple benefits from that, and that is firstly for the children themselves. They're going to be less, they will get less severe illness when they're exposed to this virus. I mean, people still get sick after they've been vaccinated, but generally it's much less severe. And so that will keep these young children out of hospital in many cases. Occasionally, there are some deaths from influenza in childhood, but fortunately it's very uncommon. So that'll be the direct effects. Then there are the indirect effects, and that is that they are then less likely to infect their parents and other family members and their grandparents, who are often providing care for young children, perhaps babysitting and so on. And this, what is called indirect protection, is very well demonstrated with this vaccine and vaccinating children, because it's been used for many years in the UK. And it's also been rolled out in Australia. So there's a lot of experience with this. And I'm very pleased that we're actually going to invest in this as a subsidised vaccine from next year.
And I know a few people personally, and I imagine there's a good few across the country, who maybe forget to get their flu vaccines or put it off for a while until later in the flu season. Why is, in your view, getting the vaccine important, not just for the individual, but also for our broader public health response as a country?
Well, when you get the vaccine, you're protected, but also protects the people around you to some extent, and also protects the healthcare system, because over winter, there's already a lot of pressure on our emergency departments and inpatient wards. And if you are vaccinated, you're just less likely to be one of those people turning up in the emergency department feeling very unwell and potentially getting admitted. So there are multiple benefits from that. And sometimes over winter, the hospitals have to cancel their elective surgery just to cope with this winter onslaught. So I think it is a very responsible thing to do. It protects your health and also other more vulnerable people. So I really urge people to get their flu vaccine. And even if you're not in one of the groups that gets the free vaccine, and many groups do, it's still a low-cost vaccine. It's recommended for everyone from 6 months of age and above. So you will get benefits. You need to get the vaccine every year because for two reasons. One is that your antibodies do decay over time, so you get less protection if you're not having it every year. And the other thing is that the virus does keep evolving. It's called drift. It's not a massive change, but it's enough to make the vaccine less effective. So that's why it's really beneficial to get the vaccine every year. It's going to be a better fit with the circulating virus.
And alongside the vaccine, what other approaches can people take? What other strategies can people adopt to reduce the impact of influenza on them and their families and friends at an individual level?
Well, what we've learned from the COVID experience is something I don't think we even talked about very much before that, and that was self-isolation. And that is that if you have a respiratory illness, stay home and don't spread it around to your workmates or schoolmates or your social contacts. You're doing them a favour. And, of course, now you can get these rapid antigen tests that don't just cover COVID-19. They also cover both major forms of influenza, A and B, and also RSV, probably the next most serious respiratory infection. They cost twice as much as the COVID RAT test, but they can give you obviously more information, and then you can know that you have something very serious in some cases. And it's helpful to know if you're feeling really crook what actually it is. And often it won't be COVID-19. It could be influenza, and that is very helpful knowledge and yet another reason not to go and mix with other people if you have any of those infections. The only other thing I'd say, and this is another, you could say, COVID-era lesson that we learnt, is that actually masks are still very effective if you are in enclosed environments. And I think the classic example is if you're a commuter on the bus or train, we do know that there's a lot of CO2, I mean, we've measured CO2 in those environments, so people are breathing in air that has been breathed out by other people in large amounts. So there is an environment to wear a mask. If you're going to be spending hours as a commuter every week, then when we move into the flu season, the mask doesn't just protect you from influenza, it protects you from all of these viruses. So I think it's worth considering if you are a commuter.
And lastly as well, obviously I mentioned earlier that Pharmac decision to fund the vaccine for that group of children, but are there any other policy responses that we could see from government to improve our resilience, not just against influenza, but also against other diseases moving forward?
Well, there are effective vaccines now available for RSV, and there is a vaccine that's been approved for older people for RSV, and they, again, it's a very serious illness that puts many elderly New Zealanders into hospital every year. But also the main group who go to hospital with RSV are young children, infants, often in the first year of life. And there are now vaccines available for them that are effective, but they're not yet approved for use in New Zealand. So we're lagging a bit behind other high-income countries in rolling out these vaccines for young children. So we can do better in these areas.
That was University of Otago's Professor Michael Baker speaking to News Director Castor about influenza and public health approaches to mitigate disease risk.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire. That was The Wire.
Era te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nā te mihi kia koutou e kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the wire for Dā Pare Thursday. Nē rā hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Labour's Shannon Halbert, the University of Auckland's Jihan Gunasekera, Te Ao Māori News' Marnie Dunlop, and University of Otago's Michael Baker. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4, but first there is some Vera Allen.
I'm so high, you couldn't touch me if you tried. I'm so thankful for this life. I'll be 21 until the day I die. If my mother saw us now, she would crawl up on the ground and make comments about my skin and the room I'm living in and how I trust. Sipping wine on the beach with you. It's your birthday, you do you. I guess I have no excuse. I don't know why I do these things. I only know I like the feeling of your hand around my neck. When my head is in the sand, I
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.